This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Turkish forces have entered northern Syria in a major escalation of the war there. It has cited Kurdish militants as its justification, even as the US and NATO have publicly denounced the move, urging Turkey to stay focused on the fight against the Islamic State. Brett McGurk, U.S. Special Envoy, said, quote, "We want to make clear that we find these clashes in areas where ISIL is not located unacceptable and a source of deep concern," end of quote. While Turkey's government claimed that it had killed 25 Kurdish fighters over the weekend, observers reported that Turkish forces had in fact killed 41 people, including civilians. Turkey's main enemy is the Syrian Kurdish YPG group, which is part of the Syrian Democratic Coalition that the US has backed in the past. Turkey recently experienced a coup attempt and a major attack on its airport in Ankara. My guest is Rahul Mahajan, PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin and a news analyst. He's written a couple of books, including on the Iraq War, including Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, as well as The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's also the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for Rising Up. Welcome back to the program, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about what Turkey's motivation is. It feels as though in most of Turkey's regional political dealings, there's always a connection with its fear over Kurds and the Kurdish movements for independence. Does that seem to be its main motivation in entering Syria for now something like about a week?
Yes, it is. So a little historical background. So when the Arab uprising started, and when in particular Syria started to not only become an armed conflict, but become relatively internationalized, Erdogan saw it as a chance to sort of make a claim as a regional power player at a level beyond what Turkey has traditionally done.
And this is the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan.
That's right. That's a move which is considered by pretty much everyone to have backfired horribly, with blowback, including the incredible spate of ISIS terrorist attacks inside Turkey. Simultaneously, or roughly, he actually made peace overtures with the Kurds that were probably reasonably sincere. What happened, however, is that as the peace process was going on, the Kurds started actually doing much better in elections than they ever had before, and the votes were being taken away from the AKP, Erdogan's party, and he saw it sort of as a betrayal of his policies by the Kurds. And so for the past year and change, there has been a renewed sort of animosity on both sides, certainly Erdogan versus any sort of Kurdish political formation, and the PKK in particular against Erdogan. So that's the background. It's a renewal of a situation that actually had calmed down quite a bit in like 2012 through 2014. Now, with the coup attempt, what Erdogan sees is that rather than trying to play all kinds of fancy geopolitical games, he wants to move first against what he considers the biggest threats, his internal enemies. That's why the rapprochement with Russia, and probably under the table rapprochement to a certain extent with the Assad regime, and the renewed effort not just on the PKK in Iraq, but on the affiliated YPG in Syria.
So let's talk about the fact that the Syria war was already complicated enough and had been basically the source of a major part of the refugee problem, and really has shocked the world in terms of civilian suffering. You already had the Syrian regime under President Bashar al-Assad, whom you mentioned, being the perpetrator of major crimes with help from Russia. Assad's regime was quite boosted. Then you had ISIS and the U.S. fighting ISIS in Syria, but trying not to be, you know, take too many sides against Assad. Now you've got Turkey as well. Turkey pushing in from the north, going towards the south. What is the impact that Turkey is going to have on the civilian suffering in Syria? How is it planning? I mean, can Turkey, you know, is it just ground troops that are trying to target the Kurdish militants, or are they dropping airstrikes? Won't Turkey's presence, you know, just make this bloodbath much worse?
Well, part of the reason for the need for the rapprochement with Russia was to enable Turkey to use its air force in these operations. After the downing of the Russian pilot last year, there was a real problem with doing that. Something about the complication here. I mean, look at the YPG, for example. They've simultaneously been essentially taking money and support from the regime, attacking ISIS, which has also gotten more backdoor support from the Syrian regime, attacking some parts of the Arab resistance, which is being supported by the United States, while they're also supported by the United States. And the latest thing is being bombed by the regime with whom they had been essentially more or less allied through most of the conflict. So every group seems to be both simultaneously allied with and fighting with every other group. So to predict what the effect on civilians of Turkey's new incursions is just impossible. I mean, certainly, I'm sure the people of Manbij are very happy no longer to be under the thumb of ISIS, except for the ones who were killed by the somewhat indiscriminate bombing by the United States. So I don't know. It's not possible to try to do these calculations, I think, even for people on the ground, let alone people at a room.
Rahul, your description of this complex situation is making my head spin. I mean, how much worse can the Syrian war get, and then Turkey jumps in to complicate things even more? Now, the Syrian YPG is part of a larger coalition of Syrian forces. Was this a coalition of Syrian forces fighting Assad? And was this also a group that had received backing from the U.S.? If so, is Turkey now essentially targeting the group that the U.S. had backed?
So look, the Syrian Democratic Coalition is just a U.S. attempt to sort of put a universalistic face on what they're doing. I mean, the truth is that the Arab resistance and the YPG are very much at odds with each other right now. And so all of the Arab fighting groups that actually have control of territory or have support are, you know, whatever they say in name, they are very much opposed to any further spread of the YPG. This is also all in the context of a tremendous amount of anger and claims on both sides of incursions where essentially Kurds are taking over traditionally Arab areas and vice versa. So there's no real basis for alliance between the bulk of the Arab resistance in Syria and the YPG right now, and so claims that is what's going on are just sort of something to paper over the contradictions for external audiences.
What about the U.S. response? The U.S. And NATO have very angrily objected to Turkey's entrance into this war. Can this impact U.S.-Turkey relations? Or is this simply Obama, you know, saying what he has to say?
So I think, again, they are threading the needle on this. So simultaneously, there are some denunciations of Turkish actions, but then you have Joe Biden telling the Kurds they have to withdraw their troops west of the Euphrates, where, you know, a large amount of Syrian Kurdish territory is east of the Euphrates. I mean, important places like Kobani and Hasaka, where they've been fighting, are well to the east. So you've got a lot of conflicting sorts of imperatives coming from the United States. Again, it's probably in part at least trying to save face with multiple sides and trying to pretend that sides that are actually mortal enemies. I mean, remember, for the Arab resistance in Syria, the regime is the number one enemy. They've fought ISIS, but the regime is the number one enemy. For the YPG, the Arab resistance is probably a bigger enemy than ISIS, although they sort of get lumped together. And now the Turkish military is possibly going to be the biggest enemy. For the Turkish military, the YPG is the biggest enemy. So,
except for the U.S., ISIS is the biggest enemy.
The U.S., which is not putting in very much as yet into the fight, is the only group that has ISIS as its main isolated primary enemy. So it pretends that this isn't, it's building an anti-ISIS coalition is little more than that.
Wow. Okay. So here is a war that, you know, in the wake of the heartbreaking images of Syrian children dying, questions are constantly being raised as to what is the world doing about the Syrian war. But we have so many competing and powerful interests, international interests within Syria, that there doesn't seem to be much end in sight. The UN certainly will, you know, doesn't seem to have much a power. You know, is it completely useless for us to ask this question? Well, I know, and I know, of course, this is a very flawed question, but how do we end this war? How, you know, what is the way out of this horrific war that just seems to get more and more complicated?
Well, that's very hard to say, and I can't really imagine a way to end the war that doesn't involve at least the threat of more serious military action, because you have a number of sides that are basically They're in it until death, or until at least there is some negotiated settlement with a guarantee of security for them. So how is the United States or any other outside broker going to get all of these non-ISIS groups to agree, first of all, that they're not going to fight each other, and to agree that ISIS is the primary enemy? Because, of course, the thing that differentiates ISIS from the others is there's no negotiation with them. There's no potential common ground to be reached with ISIS. And so to turn all these groups, which have suffered much more at the hands of each other even than they have at the hands of ISIS, to focusing on the anti-ISIS fight and to assuring each other's security and some sort of division at this point of Syria, again, something which would create monstrous complications, I don't know. I mean, so the thing that people fall back on when there's such incredible difficulty and complexity is some talk about a regional peace conference where all sides are represented. I don't know where such a conference would go if you did actually represent all sides. And I certainly think that one of the problems has been that the Arab resistance to the regime has gotten the short end of the stick on most of these efforts, despite the sort of rhetorical claims the United States makes about supporting them. I mean, right now, you can see they're suffering the most. Mm-hmm. Despite all of this talk about Manbij and Hasaka, it's Aleppo and Deraa where the most damage is being done, and that's the Assad regime with the backing of the Russians and Iranians.
Right, and in fact, on that issue, I don't know if you saw this piece in These Times magazine, Rahul, on August 15th, Terry Burke wrote an article, U.S. peace activists should start listening to progressive Syrian voices, and pointed out a big part of the problem is that many left anti-war voices in the U.S. are sort of de facto pro-Assad. Not that, sadly, the U.S. peace movement is really having any great impact on the, you know, on the war front at all. But even on the U.S. left, there seems to be a break over how to handle the Syria war, how to approach the Syria war, with some factions on the left, like they were pro Saddam Hussein in Iraq, are pro Assad in Syria, despite report after report showing that Assad is the major perpetrator of the bulk of crimes against civilians. Any thoughts on that?
I guess at this point I have low expectations. I would like the American left to stop listening at first to people who are either deranged or apologists for atrocity. I would like them to stop taking their idea of the Syrian conflict from Robert Fisk, who's writing columns that are based on the tortured testimony of people held by the Syrian regime. I mean, he's unironically sitting there in a prison talking to this guy who's been tortured and presumably will be taken away to get tortured again, and this is run by the Independent. I like them to stop listening to Seymour Hersh, who's concocting notions about the rebels attacking themselves with chemical weapons, rather than the obvious idea that the regime, which had chemical weapons, attacked rebel-held areas with them, instead of the rebels who didn't have chemical weapons attacked their own supporters. You know, that would be a nice start if people would just start paying attention to anything remotely realistic about what's happening in Syria, instead of having to believe that everything that is reported in an actual newspaper must be wrong because of some kind of nebulous media bias. Right now, the bias actually by, you know, some of the well-known left journalists here seems to be far more extreme. So that would be a good start. And then, yes, you could start looking at actual testimonies from Syrians. There are now several books out. In particular, I'd really recommend Robin Yassin Kassab's and Leila Ashami's book, which is really, you know, it's been described as the homage to Catalonia for the Syrian war. There is a lot of information out there right now, and people don't need to keep on rereading things from people who have been telling us nonsense about Syria for years.
Rahul, I appreciate your candor on that. But I want to bring up finally a side note, going back to the U.S.'s motivations and really role in the Syrian war, the stated role that it is fighting ISIS, the Islamic State. The Intercept recently had an article about a very, I think, interesting revelation that the ISIS leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, now it has been found, had been an Iraqi prisoner at the U.S.-run notorious Abu Ghraib prison. You know, and it's interesting, of course, to see ISIS sort of reenact some of these, tableaus of their soldiers with orange-clad victims, almost in a direct reference to U.S.-run prisons. How significant is this revelation? Is this, you know, should we have expected this kind of a blowback back in the Bush years when the revelations about torture at Abu Ghraib came out?
Well, first, it was always thought that al-Baghdadi was a U.S. prisoner in Iraq. The idea before had been that he'd been held in Camp Buqqa. And the Intercept article says, in fact, that's not true. There's not evidence of that. He was held in Abu Ghraib instead. The import of the story is a little odd because if they're right about this, he was probably actually held in U.S. custody for less time than most people had thought. Regardless of that, the import is pretty much the same, that what happened was these places became, for a variety of reasons, you know, jihadi school. And that's a traditional thing that happens when you put a bunch of people in prison for political reasons. But certainly if you have, I mean, every possible thing. First of all, you have the sort of torture that is explicitly and overtly degrading in some places. Secondly, you decide that you're going to teach the inmates about moderate Islam, so you bring in imams, but you don't actually know what they're saying to the prisoners. You know, every possible thing that could go wrong in terms of creating ISIS happened in those U.S. prisons. So which parts of those things actually were most formative for Baghdadi is still kind of up in the air.
Well, Rahul, I want to thank you as always for joining us today. We'll have you back on in the future, I'm sure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rahul Mahajan is a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin and a news analyst and the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's also the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for Rising Up. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.